Okay, business leaders, are you playing defense or are you on the offense? Are you just, excuse me, hey, I'm trying to talk business here. As I was saying, are you here just to play or are you playing to win? If you're in it to win, meet your next MVP, NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is your full business management system in one suite. With NetSuite, you're running your accounting, your financials, HR, e-commerce, and more, all from your online dashboard. One source of truth means every department's working from the same numbers with no data delays. And with AI embedded throughout, you're automating manual tasks, plus getting fast insights for your next move. Whether you're competing on your home turf or looking to conquer international markets, NetSuite helps you get the W. Over 40,000 businesses have already made the move to NetSuite, the number one cloud ERP.
Right now, get the CFO's Guide to AI and Machine Learning at netsuite.com/special. Get this free guide at netsuite.com/special.
Okay, guys.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps. And after that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben Stiller and Adam Scott is presented by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+.
Before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recaps.
Beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring amazing special guests from the cast and crew.
After that, we're going to keep going as we recap every episode of season 2.
The Severance podcast with Ben and Adam.
Listen and follow now on Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Representative Elliott, good morning, sir.
How's it going? Good to see you.
You're watching that DC stuff, huh?
I know. Well, I actually hadn't seen the videos, so jarring.
Yeah, it's tough. I wonder what actually happened. They're saying now no survivors. So
wow.
A few, and that's, I think it was 60-something on the plane, and I think 3 in the helicopter, but they don't know.
Wow.
Obviously, it's a Black Hawk helicopter made by Sikorsky as well, so there's a local angle to it. How are things?
Things are good. Things are heating up.
Yeah. Sessions, what are your committees? What do you got? What's your leadership here? What are you doing?
I am on finance, public health, and judiciary. I am a deputy speaker. I'm a house co-chair. I screen for the speaker, and I take out all of the union contracts now.
Jeez.
Yeah. Some responsibility. It's great.
Well, when you say the union contracts, what does that mean? You
CBAC. So when the CBAC deal gets done, I'll be the person on the floor debating it. We actually just had session this week, a couple days ago, took a couple bills out. One was regarding the trooper and DOT worker who died last year, making sure that their families are taken care of. So that was a good bill to finish. And then just took another bill out that ensures that when people apply for retirement disability, we have just better systems in place and more oversight.
What's the child tax credit thing that's going on?
We have a lot of people on that bill. I think we have over 60 introducers, so this would allow for somebody with children to have $300 to $600 less of for their adjusted gross income. It's going to be potentially a little pricey, but it goes to the right people, and we know that better childhood outcomes, long-term outcomes come from just putting more money in people's pockets when they have kids. So
yeah.
We're working on it. We'll see what happens. It's going to be a tough year, though.
Well, we're going to save the sort of budget stuff
for
820. Super important. And I sort of, like everyone that comes through, I'm really interested in what they think is going to happen. And, from the guardrails to taxes and so on and so forth. I was just curious. We just had, we had Blumenthal on. How are you viewing all the stuff that's going on? You know you're a Democrat.
Right.
I mean, how are you viewing things in D.C.?
I think a lot of how I'm viewing things is through the budgetary lens. We have a $28 billion a year budget here in Connecticut. 14 of that $28 billion is federal pass-through money. And so a lot of what we're seeing are through executive orders, what we can and can't say. That said, it's the money issues that we're worried about. And even just talking to my mayor and talking to town administrations across the state, people are getting worried about their projects getting halted. And so these are things that truly help people, and we're going to have to figure out ways to be plugging in these gaps, and we just don't know how big those gaps are going to be. So the worry right now is more of the unknown than anything else.
I put this to Blumenthal too. I mean, I guess, and again, he pushed back on this a little bit, but were you aware or self-aware, like, about how much we depend on federal money?
I had no idea that it was half of our budget. I knew it was a lot, but it's not even just that half the money goes through the state. I mean, there are just direct contracts with our towns too. Yeah. And places like Iris with that $4 million that they just lost. I mean, there's so much federal money coming to Connecticut that is more than that $14 billion that comes through the state. The breadth of it, I actually did not know.
Yeah. I didn't either. I wasn't aware. I mean, that's what, if there's anything sort of educating that came out of this whole thing about the freeze of the funding is just that. And who knows where it's going to go.
I will just say one quick thing is that while, yes, we do rely a lot on the federal government, we are one of five states in the U.S. that send more money to the federal government than we get back.
That's true.
Yes.
Josh Elliott, representative for the 88th here in studio. I mean, the big game is, I mean, I think the word of the year in Connecticut is guardrail, right? I mean, that's the word of the year. And I'm assuming you want to tweak things to get more money to spend. Is that, I mean, that's the assumption I'm making?
Yes. Right now, three majority caps are the volatility cap, revenue cap, spending cap. I think the focus is predominantly on the volatility cap.
Would you need like a constitutional amendment to change the spending cap, though? Like,
no, you just need a lot of people to vote for it if you want any change. You need more than a simple majority. You need about two-thirds of both chambers to be able to change it.
Right.
That's the issue. That said, we'll come back in a couple of years, and we're going to – there's also this issue that we tied our hands whenever we go to the bond market. We made a promise to the bond market a few years ago that any time we get more money and we have new bonds, in those bonds – we say that we will not change our volatility, revenue, and spending cap. And we're the only state that's ever done this. No state does this in the wake of that. So we've made it not only hard to change the volatility cap on its face, but we've also contractually bound ourselves to these caps.
Was that done so the bondholders would have more faith and so that you'd get more investors?
That's exactly why it was done. I wouldn't say more investors. We never had a problem getting investors.
Higher quality.
But you get you have to spend less money over time because you're considered safer.
So my assumption is always that if there's any changes, it's going to be the volatility cap.
Yes and no. I mean, that's where a lot of the focus is because of the $1.2 to $1.3 billion of additional money that's been going toward our pension and rainy day fund. And of course, our rainy day fund is fully funded now. That is where the focus is because of the additional money. That said, there is also going to be a very strong secondary focus on the spending cap as well, because even if we were to open up additional funding under the volatility cap, it would still all go towards the
because
the
there's
pensions.
A limit, right? And just to explain to people, and correct me if I'm wrong, you could say you could get X amount of millions more from tweaking the volatility cap. At some point, it hits the spending cap, and you can't spend it.
That's correct? Right. And we're, I mean, every year we're hitting the spending cap, so it's considered. But let's say like $500 to $600 million is truly non-volatile revenue. So there's no reason for us to consider it volatile. If the whole premise is that we can't be relying on Wall Street's money, which is really in large part the Gold Coast of Connecticut and the wild swings that come as a result of that. Of course, we know over the last 7 or 8 years, it's been bull market. So we've been doing really well, which we didn't expect. And I will say that we are one of the five best funded rainy day funds in the U.S. now per capita. But on the other hand, we are also doing very poorly in terms of our pensions still. We're bottom six. We used to be like near dead last, so we're still moving
it's
up.
It's getting better.
It's getting better. And we're about 50% funded. Again, we have a long way to go.
So, okay. And ultimately, for you, on the record, if you could have exactly done the way you would want to, because I have a second part of this, what would it look like?
I will say I'm one of the more liberal members of the legislature.
No!
And even I believe that there need to be general guidelines and rules. Nobody is saying get rid of the revenue cap, spending cap, volatility cap. Not a single person. All we're saying is ease it up a little bit. We had, with our deal in 2017, basically amortized our debt to around 2049, 2050, which sounds like a long time because it is. But again, it took about 80 years for us to get here.
Right.
About four generations. We're trying to fix that in the span of about two. I just think that if you do it too quickly, what we're forgetting is that the investment that we make in our ecosystem, in our in the state, that is money that we do get back. That is quality of life for people right here, right now. So it is just making maybe a 5-year average for volatility, so that's not benchmarked to this arbitrarily low number from 2016. And it's easing up our spending because of all the ways that we manage our spending. We have the most possible conservative way of managing that.
Okay, so, and we're sitting here with Josh Elliott, a representative in the 88th District here on Bryan & Company. And I'll bring it full circle. What do you expect Lamont's going to propose? Next week.
On the 5th is when he has his budget address. Nobody really knows yet. Our speaker, Matt Ritter, really believes that he will be somewhat flexible. Of course, the governor has been very vocal over the course of the last couple of years that we are not in any way to touch these caps at all. But I think that the reality, again, going back to what's happening federally, will dictate what we can and can't do. So even if the governor says what he wants to do on the 5th, we really aren't going to know what's possible until May or June when we're actually crafting that budget document. I will say that it is very likely he's going to stick to what he's been saying. He's going to say no changes to the guardrails. I'm hopeful that he is not as vehement as he's been over the past year and a half, only because we are going to be having to make sure that government stays afloat.
Well, you know, I was sort of saying, like, you have this veto-proof majority, and I don't think the governor wants to be a part of something where something gets passed, he vetoes it, and then his own party overrides him. And that's not going to happen, right?
So no, that's not going to happen. We have 102 Dems. There are, I think, 49 Republicans. And like you said, 101 would be that veto-proof majority. Of the 102 Dems, we don't all exactly see eye to eye.
No, but I also think like the optics would be so bad that no one's going to allow that to happen, even if there were the votes. But for Lamont, it sounds like, and it's funny because whether it's through Scanlon or whomever, he sort of tips his hand a little bit, and you know there's going to be $1 billion in the ability to spend anyway without tweaking it. They've even floated cutting taxes as a way to get money back to people. Is there a scenario where you could meet your budgetary needs without touching it at all?
It's really hard to know, only because things change every month. We might be getting
new projections.
What if
you lose federal money and need to tap the rainy day fund?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah. I think that was stunning to me when Lamont said that the other day about, you know, we might, you know, if this push comes to shove, we might have to tap the rainy day fund. But that's also another way for him to say we're not going to change anything.
Yeah. But also, what is the rainy day fund for?
It's for a rainy day.
I mean, if you aren't getting all this money from the federal government and you have all these programs and all this need and all this debt that we're still paying down, at what point do you touch that rainy day fund?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating. The federal component adds a different angle that 2 weeks ago we hadn't thought about.
No, we thought about it. And the reason we thought about it, at least in the legislature, was because a big topic coming up is Medicaid reimbursement. It's been like 18 years and there's been no increase. And so it's getting harder and harder for people of lesser means to be accessing good health care and proper health care and consistent health care. And so as a result of that, it's been the focus of Senator Lesser and Representative Gilchrist on the Human Services Committee to be really fighting for increased reimbursement. Of course, you can fight for things that cost money on any committee that you're on, but it always comes through appropriations. It always comes through the governor's office. So that was going to be a major focus. But the concern over and over was we're going to be probably getting less money from the federal government. And so whatever we had to do in Connecticut to solve that problem is going to be magnified. So we had already started discussing what that was going to look like.
Without knowing what Trump was going to do.
Sure. Right.
But yeah, we're in studio with Representative Josh Elliott from the 88th District. We're in full session. You know, I think it always bears a little repeating, too, in terms of, you know, the way things work in Connecticut. I don't know how much, I mean, you own, like, would you call it a boutique grocery?
It's like a natural grocery store.
In Hamden?
Correct.
Yeah. And how do you, and you opened it with your mother?
So she opened it 27 years ago, and I came on board maybe 12, 13, 14 years ago.
And so you, in terms of like your law degree, you mainly use it for your legislative work, right? I mean,
yeah, it's a basis. I'm an attorney. I don't practice. And but the reason I'm the state representative in Hampton is because I went to law school at Quinnipiac and because the business is there. So yeah. It ended up being the network.
So what's the life balance this time of year?
It always changes. I'm in my ninth year now, my fifth term. I just won my primary 82-18, and it's a fairly Democratic district. So
that primary is the election?
It's the election.
Did anyone run against you?
Well, so yeah, that's what I won 82-18 in my primary against the Democrat.
But no Republican ran against you?
This is my first time since I started running for office that I did not have a Republican challenger.
I don't like that, though.
Me neither. I agree with you. I think that we should have challengers in every race. And I'm working hard to get Democrats in places where Democrats don't think they can win. And I think it's fair for Republicans to do the same. I think that people need to feel like there's a challenge.
So what about the balance? What is it? You're up in Hartford every day?
No. So it's really the last 5 weeks. We are a part-time legislature. This year we're in January to June. By May, early May, we'll be in 3-4 days a week, sometimes 5 days a week. Of course, you can go in every day if you want to, but there's not going to be meetings. There's not going to be things going on every single day. But by May, we actually start voting on bills. Now what's happening is we finished the introduction period that ended a couple of weeks ago, and individual legislators can introduce their own bills. What's happening now is all the chairs of the relevant committees are determining what bills they're going to be actually working on over the course of session. If you're rank and file, and if you're new, there really isn't a lot to do right now. You might go to a meeting, but the meeting's going to last 5-10 minutes. Sometimes you'll go to some things that are a little bit more like about information, so you might do that for an hour or so. But by and large, you can do a lot of these online over Zoom, so you don't even have to be there in person. I will say, though, for myself, there is more responsibility than there's ever been. I've introduced myself about 40 bills. And what I'm finding
yourself are a part of, not solo, but like you're a part of 40 bills that are being presented.
Well, let me just provide context for that. Of those bills, maybe one or two are things that I myself am working on that's like my bill.
The others are co-sponsors.
The rest of them are working with advocates. The rest of them are working with colleagues. The rest of them are doing work for my mayor or doing stuff that my constituents want to see. So when I say mine, an example is medical aid in dying, which we had just talked about a little bit before off air. The vast majority of the work that I do is actually work for other people, which I actually enjoy, because what I find is that I can help guide people through the process. I've gotten wins, and I assume I'll continue getting wins. I know the people, and I know how to make things get over the finish line.
Well, I wanted to bring up aid in dying. It's not even going to be a bill this session, correct?
That's correct. So the last time it was raised was a few years ago. Last year, it wasn't raised, and this year it's not going to be raised. We've really narrowly tailored this bill. It's going to be 6 months left to live as your diagnosis. From multiple doctors, you have to get the okay from psychiatrists, and you have to get these okays over and over every month. And you have to have a 1 year living requirement in the state. There's so many ways that make this difficult to access, but we're just trying to turn it into law.
Okay, so I was going to wait on that. I was going to ask you about some of the other stuff, the other bills that are actually going to be considered. But since you brought it up, we might as well just bang it out here. So you're still, it's not going to even be put forth as a bill, but you're still working on it with the future hope of presenting it in a viable way that will get passed. So the issue isn't tabled. It's just not putting forth as an actual piece of legislation in this session.
So yes and no. It's a little technical in that there is a bill. It's a bill that I've introduced with other co-introducers. But for it to actually go anywhere, it has to get through committee. And it had historically never gotten through any committee up until about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And it got through public health for the very first time. And I actually got myself onto public health specifically for this issue, and also for the issue of vaccinations as well, and eliminating the religious exemption for kids in K-12. And then once it got through public health, it was determined that there was a component that said that we are essentially changing what murder means. And so it was then going to go to the Judiciary Committee. And so as a result of that, I got myself onto the Judiciary Committee. And that's where it's been stalled, is that we just don't have the votes there. I am certain we have the votes in both chambers. And I'm not sure where the governor's at, but getting it out of the bit-by-bit process is where we're getting hung up. And since nothing much has changed on Judiciary, the chairs of the Public Health Committee feel that we need to be spending our time on things that can actually become law this year.
We're back with Josh Elliott from the 88th District here on Brian and Company. Phil Collins, 74 years old today, by the way. That's Genesis song, though. And that video was groundbreaking with the puppets. It was really incredible. Just to finish up the conversation with, regarding the aid in dying, I didn't ask you permission for this, so you can avoid it if you want to. Why is this issue important to you?
I, as with many issues, don't have personal experience. It just feels right. I read this book called Being Mortal by Atul Gawande, who wrote another book called The Checklist Manifesto. He actually led the WHO for a number of years. And for him, this was a discussion about the doctor's perspective and approach to end of life care and what it actually means to live a meaningful life. And I was already sort of on board, but I think this really clinched it. And then it just became one of those things. The more conversations I had and the more people who had personal experiences, the more strongly I felt about making sure that this became law.
Yeah, for me, my parents are in their 80s and their quality of life isn't great. And I think about what I want for myself, and I don't know and who knows when you really start to feel your mortality, not to get all metaphysical, but who knows how I'll feel. I might want to hang on to every breath.
Sure.
I don't know. But part of me is like, if I can't do stuff, I don't want to hang on.
It's a lot of it's a self-determination issue. And I think what we see in terms of states that have passed this law.
How many have it?
I think there's seven that have it right now.
Vermont is the only one in New England?
Vermont is the only one in New England. And Oregon, I think, was the very first. And they've had it for over 20 years. But what we see is that the vast majority of people that ask for the medication end up not taking it. They just want to feel as though they have control.
It's so interesting. What would you handicap in the next 5 years something getting done?
Well, we have to see if Ned runs again. We have to see if the chairs of the relevant committees, Public Health and Judiciary, stay the same. As long as things stay the same, there's no real movement. I'm a believer that people's minds can change and that over the course of time, people do change perspective. At the same time, in the short term, as long as it's the same people, we can expect this to not move.
Okay. You brought up Ned. I don't want to ask that yet. We have about 7 minutes. Of the bills you're a part of that are going to be actively considered, what are the one or two or three, whatever, that are most important to you?
The most important, as usual, are issues of the way that we tax. We punish our working poor and our middle class, and that is a result of our really unfair property tax structure where we heavily rely on that for municipalities to spend on fire, police, and our education system. So three big bills. I'm going to be organizing the Tax Equity Caucus again this year that I will be pushing. The first is, as we mentioned, changing some of the guardrails. As you mentioned, the child tax credit. I have a bill that increases the capital gains tax. And that's really going to be the focus. I do have one very specific bill that I really love as well. It addresses income tax bracket creep. Are you familiar with this? That's the idea that if you don't tie each tax bracket to inflation, then as you make more money and you're going up into different tax brackets, you might not actually have better buying power, but you are going to be spending more towards the government because you are now in a higher tax bracket. It's just a very basic question of fairness. And our federal government has been indexing tax brackets for decades and decades and decades. There's no reason that Connecticut doesn't do it.
Why increase capital gains? Like, people are so self-conscious about growth in Connecticut and they don't want to alienate the money. Why would you want to hike that?
Because every time there's a downturn, it is people in the middle class whose 401ks get absolutely demolished. People have to work for years and years longer. And it's the ultra wealthy. That's where they make their money. So if you're making over, I think, $2 million a year, it's like over 95% of that comes from capital. And people are still going to be investing, even if you ask them to pay a little bit more into the system. And we have studies that come out every few years that show that the more money you make in our state, the less you pay as a percentage of your income to state and local taxes. And for me, that is the holy grail of information in terms of what we put out in our state, in terms of what is and is not fair.
Yeah, I mean, taxation, I don't know about as well as you do. I worked in financial journalism for a long time, and the goal always, whether it's individuals, wealthy individuals, or companies, is to pay as little as possible.
Sure.
And that's just the way, because it maximizes profits and so on and so forth. But there's this notion that, you know, if you have more taxes on companies, then it's they don't want to stay wherever they're going to go wherever the cheapest taxes are, and so you could lose businesses. Having said that, like I do feel like there should be fairness. Like why should a company pay 2% when I'm paying 38% or whatever it is? And you're right. I mean, as a proud member of the middle class, we get hammered in every phase of life. But it's hard to get those things done and get equity without being labeled as, you know, someone who's going to run business out of town.
Sure.
And so on.
There's studies that are out there, long-term longitudinal studies that show that the way that people, specifically the wealthy, migrate in and out of states is just not dependent on taxes. And it's a very, very easy threat. And everybody has an anecdote, especially people on the Gold Coast, of somebody who says that they're going to move. The fact is that people have been leaving Connecticut for as long as Connecticut's been around. People have been leaving for warmer climates. And yes, Florida does not have an income tax, so it seems very much that that is the reason why. But more often than not, people just don't want to live in Connecticut get after a certain point.
You think that's really what you think?
Yeah.
Josh Elliott, 88th District here on Brian and Company. It's the parlor game we always like to play. You talked about whether, you know, in terms of the aid in dying, some of that will depend on what he does. How do you feel at this moment about what he's going to do?
It's interesting because it's changed. And I would say this 6-8 months ago, I would have said 70-30 that our governor probably doesn't run again. And now I'm starting to think that based on hiring decisions, based on verbiage,
this Blanchard thing coming back.
Sure. And based on what is happening federally, feeling as though he has to be here to help, in a sense, protect our state. I would flip those numbers. I would say 70-30. I think he probably runs again. But who knows?
So I've been very, in the last almost a year, very much in the camp that he's going to run again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, his wife still very much wants to do what she's doing.
Right.
And the state financially is in great shape relative to where it was.
Right.
And you know, since the pandemic, he's enjoyed incredible approval ratings.
Correct.
But the one thing you said there, I'm not sure I agree with it. I'm curious. Like, I think that the Trump presidency, and like we mentioned, the potential pressure on something like the Rainy Day Fund could incentivize him not to. So I was always like, I was always, since the election, and I assumed it was not going to be his, it was going to be his final term. Then people started telling me, don't be so sure. Mm. And then he likes the job and he's doing well and he's popular, but the Trump stuff might make him not want to be around.
That has been a part of the conversation as well. The job is going to be just so much less fun. And even for the legislature, it is going to be much less proactive and so much more reactive. Chairs want to give themselves the bandwidth to respond to some of these errant executive orders.
Well, but just take the narrative of like, what if the narrative changes and you have to draw from the Rainy Day Fund?
Exactly right.
That's going to shock the system. And that's a headline that voters are going to be like, whoa.
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah.
And even if it is because federal money is drying up and you need to, you know, fill some holes, that's going to be more of a scramble than, hey, let's just keep paying down pension debt.
Yeah, I think we have the potential of having a really angry constituency based on things that are outside of our control.
Now, is it safe to say that you would definitely run if he doesn't? Or
it is something that I would seriously consider.
And, you know, there's a lot of names. I mean, we just had Aaron Stewart. I mean, she's obviously a Republican.
Sure.
But, you know, whether it be Luke Bronin or Sean Scanlon or William Tong.
Yep.
What motivates you to say, hey, I'm better than they are as a potential candidate?
Someone who volunteered for the Bernie Sanders campaign and who is just obsessed with fairness in the system, I think that we come at the issue of our tax structure from very different lenses. And I think that especially seeing what's happening federally with the billionaires running the Trump campaign and the who knows what sort of like insane giveaways they're going to get now that they've gotten their winner. I'm just concerned about democracy. And I think that if you aren't talking about class, if you aren't talking about labor, you aren't talking about workers' rights, you aren't talking about the middle class and the way that government is inherently taxing in an unfair way and being honest about how you actually want to address that, I come at this work from a very different place.
John, and that's why it's important to have you on the show. We like to have balance, and a lot of our listeners don't agree with you on everything.
Of course.
I think it's just really important to have the dialogue. So thank you.
Appreciate it.